Dave Fanning on 2FM.
Now on the programme, I want to talk with journalist and staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, Patrick Radden Keefe. He's the author of the prize-winning book Empire of Pain. It's about one of the richest families in America, the Sacklers, and their involvement in the United States opiate crisis, and the award-winning Say Nothing, a true story about murder and memory in Northern Ireland. In his new book called Rogues, or to give it the full title, Rogues, the true stories of grifters, killers, rebels and crooks, he brings together a dozen of his most celebrated long-form articles from the New Yorker magazine. Now, the stories range from the capture of notorious drug lord El Chapo to a portrait of Mark Burnett, the reality TV producer of The Apprentice, who paved the way for Donald Trump to become president. Also, there's the Dutch woman who exposed the crimes of her gangster brother, the German vintage wine collector accused of forging the provenance of his fine wine collections, and loads more besides. So, Patrick Radden Keefe is with us now, and welcome back to the programme. Patrick, there are so many places I could start in this book. I'll tell you, I'm going to start here with this one. It's called A Loaded Gun, A Mass Shooter's Tragic Past. It's about a neurobiologist at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, a woman called Amy Bishop, who one day, without warning, took out a gun and shot her colleagues. Tell me about Amy Bishop, Patrick.
So Amy Bishop, you know, it's one of these funny things where, not even funny, but deeply tragic, that in the States we have reached this point where mass shooters, it happens all the time here. You know, they're a dime a dozen. We have a new mass shooting every week. Amy Bishop was a mass shooter from 2010, and she was unusual in a few respects. First and foremost, that she was a woman, that very few women commit these kinds of awful crimes. And then on top of that, she was this Harvard-trained academic at the University of Alabama. She came from this very kind of highly educated elite background, and it emerged that she'd been denied tenure. Yeah. At the university sometime before shooting six of her colleagues. What was interesting to the story for me was not that, though. It was the backdrop. So after this shooting happened in 2010, it emerged that in 1986, when Amy Bishop was growing up just outside of Boston, not far from where I grew up myself, in a town called Braintree, she shot and killed her younger brother, Seth. And there was only one witness to the shooting. It was their mother, Judy. And when the cops came, Judy said, "I saw the whole thing. It was an accident." And so that was the way into this story for me. Was my editor, initially he said, "Oh, you should write about Amy Bishop." And I said, "Oh, I don't care why she shot her colleagues. You know, a mass shooter is not that interesting to me. She's a cipher. She's clearly mentally ill." And he said, no, there's this story with the mother. And that's really interesting, because what happened is you had this terrible shooting in 1986. Judy Bishop, the mother, only had two children. She watches one kill the other. And in a split second, she has to make a decision about what she's going to say about what happened in that kitchen. And when the cops come, she says it was an accident, nothing to see here. And nobody ever investigates. Amy never gets therapy. And then years later, you get this terrible shooting in Alabama. And that seemed really interesting to me, because I feel as though I had actually just had a kid myself. When I started getting into this, I think I'd actually just had my second child. And for any parent, you know, you may not be able to relate to a mass shooter, but I think you can certainly relate to the idea that you have another parent who loses one child and is about to lose the other.
Yeah.
And says, "Oh, it was an accident." And so what that story was all about, I did end up talking to Amy Bishop, who was in prison, but I spent a lot of time in the town talking to people who I think had engaged in a kind of cover-up in 1986, not a nefarious cover-up, but more a conspiracy of compassion. And listen, I think it's funny, you know, having spent time in Ireland and written a book about Northern Ireland, I think these things happen there as well. When you have a close-knit community and something terrible happens behind the closed door of your neighbor, that there's a strong human impulse to just look the other way. You know, to not talk about it, to not want to investigate, and I think that's an impulse that comes out of kindness a lot of the time, and yet I think it can have devastating results.
Do you know, funny when you say the Northern Ireland book, I mean, Say Nothing and Empire of Pain as well. I mean, I mentioned them earlier on. Those two books have been lauded so often and so many awards. Do the awards? There's no kind of vindication or justification or, "Hey, I feel good." It's just nice to get, is it? And then you move on. You're never looking for that, are you?
No, I mean, it's always nice. And I think those two books have had a lot of success around the world the last couple of years. But the thing to remember, right, is I'm not new to this. I mean, those are my respectively my third and fourth books, and the first two books didn't set the town on fire. So I've been on the other side of that equation, and it helps me keep it in perspective in the sense that I don't take the awards or, you know, a book becoming a bestseller as in itself a measure of the worth of the project, right? You have to.
Okay, you were able to interview her for that story. Now, but do you enjoy the challenge of interviewing others when you can't interview the perpetrator themselves or the person at the centre? I mean, and public records and the exhaustive research, the actual process.
I love it. Yeah, I do. Which people might think. It makes me a bit strange, but yeah, I love the research and the process and the challenge. So as you indicated, in about half of the stories in Rogues, I'm writing about somebody who won't give me an interview. They won't give me access. And so then I have to work twice as hard, right? Because I want the picture I'm painting of them to be pretty vivid and intimate. But in order to do that with somebody you haven't had the chance to sit in a room with, you really need to interview lots of people who've known them. You need to dig up any records you can, court records, letters they might have written, speeches they might have given, anything you can to kind of help you paint that picture in a situation in which you don't have the big central interview. I love that. I love the challenge of it. And I love the little victories of, you know, you go into the archive or you find, when I was working on my book about the Sacklers, I tracked down a woman who'd been a housekeeper for the family for 30 years. And what a coup as an interview to be able to sit with somebody who was in their house. They hardly noticed her, but she saw everything for three decades.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, just a few more example things to jump in there. I mean, the Swiss bank heist one with the computer technician who exposed a Geneva bank's darkest secrets and, you know, liar or hero is what you'll have to find out when you read the book. The untapped iron ore, Israeli billionaire, Africa, rest in control. The Lockerbie brother, maybe did he solve the case of one of the victims? I mean, the brother of one of the victims, etc. But let's go to two I want to mention here. The first one is El Chapo, which is fair enough, obviously, that I would. I mean, like, such bizarre stuff, especially getting a phone call saying, you know, when you pick up the phone and it's like, oh God, these guys are going to get heavy. It's who on the phone? His lawyer kind of thing. Yeah, will you write his memoirs? What? That's fantastic. But anyway, it's kind of funny the stuff you say, like he was like, the El Chapo was into gourmet food and Viagra and all the rest of it and that. And he goes into this restaurant at one stage and like he tells everybody to give them his phone. He's killed millions of people and they all give the phone and then just for protection, he's with all his goons and then he leaves and he gives them their phones back and he pays for all their meals as well. And it's just the kind of madness that's around this guy. So tell me about El Chapo and how you found a way in to tell the story.
Yeah, I'd been interested in him for years. Initially, actually a long time, 10 years ago this summer, I think, I wrote my first big piece about him, which was not for The New Yorker, it was for The New York Times Magazine. Before I went full-time at The New Yorker, I wrote a cover story for The New York Times Magazine about El Chapo. And I was just intrigued at the time because he was living in hiding. Nobody could catch him. And I was interested in him as a businessman. I mean, obviously, as you say, he was a murderous criminal. But he also ran this thriving multi-billion-dollar international commodities business, this drug business. And I wanted to know more about how you do that. And so I wrote initially a story. I thought of it as like a Harvard Business School case study of a Mexican drug cartel. I was kind of looking, how does this work? How does he run this whole enterprise? And then when he was captured, I got a call from my editor on the weekend saying, oh, my goodness, you got to write about the kid. They finally got this guy who was like, you know, Zorro, who's kind of hiding away up in the hills. And they finally captured him. And so I went down to Mexico. I interviewed all these people who were involved in this clandestine operation to pick him up. And it was a fascinating story. As you say, I mean, when he was living in hiding, it was one of these strange things where the authorities kind of knew where he was. They just couldn't get him. And there were all these funny kind of close scrapes. This one I thought was amusing, that you'd have these moments where U.S. intelligence, which was desperate to get him, would get intelligence about his location. And they would feed it to their Mexican counterparts. But there was a lot of corruption in Mexico, and he had bought off all kinds of people. And so there were always these instances where they'd know where he was, and then they'd show up, you know, at a resort on the Pacific, and he would slip out the back. And it got to the point where the Americans at the U.S. Embassy in Mexico City took to joking that there's no word in Spanish for surround.
Right.
Because he managed to get away. But they finally got him.
Yeah.
that time, and then he subsequently escaped again and was caught again.
Yeah.
So he's a larger than life figure. So but I wasn't going to write his memoirs, though. I thought that sounded like a bad idea.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure about that. Anyway, examining the background of a criminal, can it make them seem unduly sympathetic in some ways? You know, maybe even as far as victims themselves?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's something I think about all the time. I think that in order to do, I don't think anybody's born evil. And I also don't think that it helps anyone if I kind of take on a position of squinty-eyed judgment from the very beginning of my pieces. I want to know how they got to where they are. That doesn't mean that I suspend judgment. This came up with my IRA book, right? That I was looking very closely at the beliefs and behaviors of people who did some terrible things. And I wasn't doing that to romanticize what they did or to justify what they did, but I wanted to understand how they saw it. I think there's a value in that. And I think that's true with some of the worst people in the world. I think that's true with Chapo Guzman as well. I don't think it's especially helpful for us to just say, oh, I have nothing in common with that person. I'm going to sit in smug judgment of them. I think better to try and understand how, as human beings, they come to stray to the degree that they do.
Okay, well, look, there are 12 brilliant essays in this book, and they're taken down through the years from you writing for The New Yorker. It's called Rogues, True Stories of Grifters, Killers, Rebels and Crooks by Patrick Radden Keefe. And Patrick, just on the actual writing and the way you do, before I go into another example, I mean, there's knife-edge suspense in an awful lot of these stories. And so as a master storyteller, does it just come naturally to tell it in such a way that suspense is kind of built in when describing how these crimes unfolded? I mean, are you striving for that, or are you very aware of doing that? I mean, like, there are times when you could leave the description and approach as very kind of matter of fact, maybe cold and dull, you know, like Joe Friday in Dragnet, just the facts, ma'am. But like, I'm glad you don't. Are you aware of that all the time, and do you try and feed it?
Yeah, I'm thinking about it all the time. I mean, when I'm reading something, I love nothing more than the feeling that the person who's written what I'm reading is holding all the cards.
Yeah.
And they've given a lot of thought to when they're going to deal out each card to me. I love that. I love that feeling that I'm in good hands and that I have twists and turns coming. And so when I approach a story, part of what I'm thinking about is when do you need to meet this character? When do you need to learn that? When should I reveal this particular detail? And hopefully I'm doing it in a way that will keep you engaged and will unfold with some of the mystery and surprise that life does.
Yeah, well, that's the point. I mean, by the way, have you read Dashiell Hammett? Have you read Raymond Chandler, Truman Capote?
I grew up on all of them.
Yeah, right. Okay, I was just wondering. Okay, let's go to one of those stories now. And I could nearly say, why is this in the book? Mark Burnett, what's he doing there?
Well, I think he's a kind of a rogue. I mean, the book's not just about criminals, right? It's about people who,
absolutely,
through force of will, reshape the world.
Okay, first of all, tell me who he is.
Yeah, so Mark Burnett is he's English. He's from East London, and he was a paratrooper who fought in the Falklands and then ends up in Los Angeles without immigration papers. He doesn't have a green card. He gets off a plane and just walks out into L.A., and he gets into the television business, becomes a reality TV producer, and makes The Apprentice with Donald Trump. And so Mark Burnett is really the one who took Donald Trump, who at the time was kind of a punchline in New York tabloids, and recast him as this, you know, hugely successful, brilliant billionaire in The Apprentice. I think without Mark Burnett, there is no Trump
presidency. Well, you make that case so strongly here that if we had a big long chain, the single most important link in that seems to be Mark Burnett in terms of how Trump went from what he was, I don't know, failed businessman or whatever it is, or a bit of an idiot or whatever, to President of the United States of America. There's no question about it that you make the link. Just as a matter of interest, there's an Irish connection to that link, because Mark Burnett is married to an Irish woman who studied at the Abbey Theatre here from Northern Ireland, played Jackie Kennedy on television, best known for Touched by an Angel, Romy.
Touched by an Angel, yeah, exactly. Mark Burnett, who is the most L.A. thing ever. Mark Burnett, when he introduces his wife, says, "I literally am touched by an angel."
Right. Does he now? But like certain things that he did, he met Trump because he was doing, was it, I don't know, the program, one of those first reality TV programs where he rented an ice rink, which of course belonged to Donald Trump.
Yeah, and he and his big appeal to Trump was he realized that it was the Trump wanted it to be called the Trump Woman Ice Rink. And so Burnett gives this speech in which he says, "Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Trump Woman Ice Rink. And we're so glad that you could come to the Trump Ice Rink with Mr. Trump, and he's here, Mr. Trump, 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 Trump." And Trump came up afterwards and said, "You're a genius."
Yeah, but the program on television, it was like, it was kind of almost comedy in that he was winking at the audience or winking at the other people and that. And they took it up wrong. The audience took it up as this guy's kind of real. And did Mark Burnett realize at some stage, wow, maybe I've created a monster?
Well, that's what I kept wondering. And he, you know, Burnett wouldn't talk to me and particularly wouldn't talk about Trump. And I think there are people around him who feel as though he did create a monster. But I think part of what's so interesting about Burnett is I don't think he's the most self-reflective guy. I think to him, politics is just entertainment by other means. Trump is a star. It all works out in the end. I don't think he has a great deal invested in the notion of the sacredness of the civic institutions that Trump has helped to undermine.
No, indeed. And Romy Downey, by the way, is the wife I mentioned there, which is a fascinating story, the two of them too, and the religious TV and all the money involved in it, etc. So let's just take one other story that I mean, you have Anthony Bourdain at the end of the book. Tell me about that.
So there's another one where, you know, not a criminal by any means, but a guy with his own. I'll put it to you this way: having known Tony quite well, he would have been charmed to be included in a collection called Rogues. I had written a couple of quite dark pieces, two of them in the book. I'd written about the Lockerbie bombing, and then I'd written about the big trial of the Boston Marathon bomber. And so those are both quite dark.
Just remember, the big trial of the Boston Marathon bomber goes back to the Una bomber as well, because it's Judy Clark and the kind of death penalty attorney, if you like. The two of them, sorry, no, who was it that ended up in the same jail? Oh, it was El Chapo and the Boston Marathon. Yeah,
there are these funny connections. That's right. Mm. And so I'd written these two quite dark pieces, and I'd done Say Nothing in my, I've been working on Say Nothing, and my editor said, "Oh, we got to give you something fun. What would you most like to do? What would be a real treat for you?" And I said, "I'd like to travel the world with Anthony Bourdain." And so I spent a year writing about him, hanging out with him. I went to Vietnam with him when he met up with President Obama in Vietnam, and really got to know him quite well. And I could tell along the way that he was going through a dark place in his life, and some of that is reflected in the piece.
Yeah.
But of course I had no inkling that he would eventually kill himself. But the piece came out, you know, probably about a year before he ended his life. And, I hope it captures some of the life force. I mean, it's
oh,
a great
God,
paradox.
Yeah, it does.
That nobody was more alive.
Are you fascinated in general by what makes us human, especially of those who clearly are imperfect?
Absolutely. That's very much, the angle that I pursued. Judy Clark, the woman you mentioned, I wrote this big profile in the book of this death penalty lawyer who only represents the worst of the worst, like the Unabomber, like the Boston Marathon bomber. And she has this thought that, you know, nobody's born evil, that they get there, that things happen to them along the way. And that is, you know, I'm not a lawyer and I'm not looking to justify what anybody has done. But on a human level, that's the question that really intrigues me.
Yeah, because, you know, I would think, and I'd like to see if you think this too, do you think that you've got a special gift for reading people?
I don't know about a special gift, but I like to read people, and over the years I think you get better at it.
Like, you know, each piece is more or less, it comes down to kind of one person. It's a one person thing. It's either one person thing before you start anyway, or it becomes that. You know, usually nefarious types, El Chapo or the Dutch gangster Wim Hollander, is that his name, or Hollander or something?
Perfect pronunciation.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. But like, I mean, all of that kind of thing, you have to piece it all together then. So eventually, when you looked back on these stories, did you change anything about them?
No, I didn't. I mean, I felt pretty good about them. The thing that is strange is that when you, if you have the time and the resources that I do to put together a big piece, you want to write the definitive version of the story. You want to write just the be-all and end-all version of the story. But the trouble, of course, is life doesn't stop just because you publish a New Yorker article about it, right? So that was the challenge for me, was in figuring out, in this book, there are these little postscripts. Originally, I was going to do something much longer, but it's, you know, I wrote about Benny Steinmetz, the richest man in Israel, who engaged in this very corrupt deal
in Africa,
mining assets in Africa. And And the case just kept going and going and going. You know, when I wrote about him, I met with him in Cap d'Antibes in the south of France, and he always seemed to be kind of two steps ahead. But eventually he gets convicted in Switzerland. And so there are things like that where there are these big postscripts to the stories. And that's always frustrating that I feel like just when I've got the thing kind of pinned under glass where I want it in my story, you know, life keeps unfolding.
Yeah, indeed. Well, listen, as a final question before I do a little bit of wrapping up about this, because it's just a great book. Are you a fan of old fashioned journalistic fact finding, nearly a pencil behind your ear with a notebook kind of reporting?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a to me, there's a romance in the work, and glamour is probably the wrong word because there are a few professions that are less glamorous. But since I was young, it's had a strong appeal to me. And you said at the outset that in some ways, you know, we live in a moment in which everybody's getting their news on social media. You have your facts, I have mine. Everything gets reduced to a tweet or a bumper sticker or a meme. And so I think in some ways this kind of work is more important and more in jeopardy than it's ever been.
Yeah,
so all the more reason that I want to keep doing it.
Well, it is a thought-provoking examination of morality and follies and motivation and choices. 12 page-turning stories of intrigue, fascination and skullduggery. I love that word, skullduggery. And, you know, honestly, if you wanted to just jump in and take your 30 pages and do another one later on, you could do that at any time, at any given time, in fact. So once again, Patrick, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you on the programme. Congratulations on the collection from The New Yorker. Patrick Radden-Keefe it is. And a final one, I suppose I should say, is did you see Dope Sick on TV and were you okay with it?
Yeah, I did. I thought it was great. I thought they did a really nice job I thought that the way in which they looked at the opioid crisis was compelling and really smart.
Yeah, I could be mean and say, what are you working on next? Because I'd be fascinated, but you probably won't tell me, will you?
I would never tell.
No, I thought so, yeah. Patrick, thank you so much for talking with us on the program today. Good man. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Dave Fanning on 2FM.